have a master's degree in physiology, biomechanics, and human nutrition. I've spent the past 2 decades competing in some of the most masochistic events on the planet, from SEALFIT Kokoro, Spartan Agoji, and the world's toughest mudder, to 13 Ironman triathlons, brutal bow hunts, adventure races, spearfishing, plant foraging, freediving, bodybuilding, and beyond. I combine this intense time in the trenches with a blend of ancestral wisdom and modern science, search the globe for the world's top experts in performance, fat loss, recovery, hormones, brain, beauty, and brawn to deliver you this podcast. Everything you need to know to live an adventurous, joyful, and fulfilling life. My name is Ben Greenfield. Enjoy the ride. Oh, well, hello. I actually have a little bit of an apology to make to you. I am not enamored with the audio quality of today's podcast episode, but the content is freaking through the roof. This is actually part two of the Precision Medicine Conference that I attended and spoke at down in Kentucky. And so I gave a 90-minute presentation on blood and biomarker interpretation. If you missed that podcast episode, you can go listen to it. It's over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/Kentucky. That's bengreenfieldfitness.com/Kentucky, not spelled with an I, spelled with an E, even though I said it Kentucky. But today's episode, what we did the evening after I gave the presentation was myself and 4 other physicians sat down and did a really comprehensive Q&A from the audience. But we did the Q&A during dinner. People were eating. There was like silverware clanking. The audio wasn't great. We weren't like hooked up to lav mics. It was just one camera with an audio feed. But I thought, you know, what the heck? The information is so interesting that I think you're going to learn a lot. I mean, we talk about nutrigenomics. We talk about genetic testing, the ApoE gene for Alzheimer's. We went deep. And here's the thing, though. Whenever it's a podcast like this where you may have to like turn up your volume or maybe make your ears a little bit more sensitive, this might not be one to listen to while you're pounding away in the treadmill or working out at the gym. Maybe, you know, press pause and save this one for a walk or a time when you're able to focus a little bit more, because I personally think the audio is not that great. But again, I wanted to give you this this information. So I hope you find this helpful. And because there's going to be plenty of show notes and links for you from this episode, you can go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/Kentucky2. That's Kentucky the number 2, to listen or to read the comprehensive show notes that I always create for you. All right, folks, clinical research has shown that therapeutically and for overall health and well-being, the most critical time to ground is when you sleep. The electrons you absorb when grounding neutralizes free radical damage, squelches inflammation, restores healthy endocrine function, enhances cellular gating and circulation. That then improves the cellular uptake of nutrients and oxygen and hormones while maximizing the removal of cellular waste, and you can now ground when you sleep. This company called Ultimate Longevity makes indoor grounded sleeping devices, and they've done clinical research studies on grounding the human body for health. When you sleep on these mats, you get 6 to 8 hours of uninterrupted grounding, meaning I could travel, unroll it onto my hotel room bed, and fight all of the radiation, the inflammation I got from flying in the airplane right there during a full night of sleep. Full body grounding, which is what these mats give you versus just your feet on the ground, maximizes the electron transfer, because the more surface area contact, the more beneficial the electrons, the more the results. So you get these amazing benefits. And inside your body, this stream of electrons works as an anti-inflammatory, pain-relieving, anti-aging, antioxidant boost, squelching inflammation all night long. They've got over 20 peer-reviewed research studies that have been published on the extensive health benefits of grounding. For vagal tone, serum electrolytes, thyroid function, blood glucose, blood viscosity, sleep, pain, stiffness, blood pressure, stress, even depression and anxiety. It's crazy. So you can go to ultimatelongevity.com/Ben to get your hands on these grounding mats. You can do mattress, pillow, blankets, a whole bunch of other valuable tools to help you bring your inflammation down and jumpstart your healing process. Again, it's ultimatelongevity.com/Ben. Well, folks, you and I, or the average American at least, spend an average of 90% of time indoors, breathing around 30,000 gallons of air daily.
According to the EPA, indoor air can be 2 to 5 times more polluted than outdoor air, and in some cases 100 times more polluted, especially like your home gym where you're breathing in even more air. This can be a serious issue. Data shows that air pollution is responsible for nearly 7 million premature deaths around the world. So you need air purifying technology, and the one that I like as a standalone system that doesn't require you to go re-outfit your entire home's AC system or ducts is called the Air Doctor. The Air Doctor filters out dangerous contaminants and allergens like pollen, pet dander, dust mites, and mold, so your lungs don't need to. Their Ultra HEPA filter has been independently tested to remove 99.99% of tested bacteria and viruses and virtually 100% of particles as small as 0.003 microns. They also feature whisper jet fans, 30% quieter than normal ordinary air purifiers, and they are extremely affordable and accessible. Furthermore, they're going to give you up to 39% off of one of their extremely impressive and efficacious air filters, or up to $300 off today. Here's how you lock this in. You go to airdoctorpro.com/benG. You can get one with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund, minus shipping, but you're going to love it. airdoctorpro.com/benG. You'll get up to 39% off or up to $300 off. So lock it in today, folks. You'll enjoy it. Clean air is something everybody deserves. You can get it with the Air Doctor.
Hi there. My name is James, and I'm the editor and the producer of the podcast. And like Ben said in the intro to this show, the audio is a little bit wonky. There's only one microphone picking up pretty much everything, and so I did my best to get all of the extraneous noises. But in particular, the questions that were asked by the audience were particularly difficult to hear. So what I'm going to do is just listen to the questions, and I will record them and insert them into the recording, and then you'll hear the panel of experts answer the questions for you. Here we go. Enjoy it.
And I just thought it'd be great to have him up on the panel as well, just after talking with him a little bit. I know we have a lot of healthcare providers here, so this is not about us as experts telling you anything. This is a discussion. So if anybody has anything to add, we would love to hear it. I'm going to go ahead and go through some of the questions. We had a couple questions specifically for Ben based on your presentation. How does Ben feel about the chili pad long-term if you're sleeping on it at 64 degrees? What about the EMFs? What do you think about EMFs and a chili pad?
How come they couldn't just stick to hair gel?
Jeez. A little tough question.
Yeah, so I mean, anytime you have something plugged in next to your bedside, you do need to be aware of any type of dirty electricity that might be kicking off. There are home meters you can use, like an acoustimeter, for example, to actually measure that. You can also hire a building biologist. You know, I did a whole podcast with a guy named Brian Hoyer, who went through our home and did a building biology analysis of how much electricity was next to the bed. In case of something like a chili pad or any larger unit like that plugs in next to the bedside. And the chili pad, by the way, it's a mat that circulates cold water or hot water, whatever you want, underneath the top sheet, with the idea being that if your core is cooler while you sleep, your deep sleep levels are enhanced and your sleep latency and sleep efficiency is improved. What I have is a power strip next to my bedside for the few things that I do plug in and run during the night. I use one made by a company called Belkin, and it has its own built-in dirty electricity filter. So that's what I do, is I just plug everything into that. Everything else in the bedroom is off. And it's not as good as using a kill switch in your bedroom, just turning everything off. You know, some people will literally just flip the breaker and turn everything off. Or get a kill switch installed, but I use that dirty electricity filter, and it does a pretty good job based off of the measurements that I've done with it. So that's the way that I do things. And then some appliances, like what's another thing I sleep on? Like a biomat, for example, that has its own dirty electricity filter built into it. So a lot of companies these days, and kind of the biohacking sector, whatever you want to call it, they do a pretty good job building in some dirty electricity filtration.
And if you're looking for a building biologist, there actually are zero in the entire state of Kentucky. If you're a Kentuckian, which is kind of frustrating, so you have to bring someone in. I'm building a house right now.
Import them.
I had to bring somebody in, so it's kind of frustrating. But if you're building a house or something like that, it's probably worth it. The chili pad also, I had one. My wife and I, that's the one thing we probably argue about most, is like the temperature at night. Someone just asked if there's a chili pack for two people. There's not. So you'd have to get two different ones if you want two different temperatures. It produces a little bit of sound, though, so if you don't like sound, it's going to be annoying. I don't like sound, so I actually mailed mine to Mike, who likes a little bit of sound, so it creates some white noise for you, too, just to keep that in mind when you're thinking about getting one.
Yeah, you get a his and hers package. I got one for Jessa. It's never been used, ever.
Sounds complicated.
Yeah.
Do you like it, Mike?
Ish. I don't know. For me, I kind of like the cooling aspect of it, but it's actually fairly thick. So whenever I'd sleep on my side, I'd have a side sleeper, it would just irritate me because it was just too rough to sleep on.
Princess and the pea over here.
Very sensitive.
It's good guy.
It's good for meat sweats.
So just do a couple more from Ben's presentations. Ben, do you think GPL's mycotoxins are not valid? You know what that means? If not, we have clarification.
A clarification on that.
Great Plains Lab. Great Plains Lab. Mycotoxin test from all.
I think it's not valid?
Yeah, I mean, you didn't mention that. I didn't know if you were familiar with
the only reason I mentioned Cyrex as an option was because I was talking about food allergy testing, like if you want to get all your arrays ordered through them at once. But Great Plains does a good,
they do a good
mycotoxin. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just to do another one from Ben's. Ben, you mentioned 3.8 thyroid is normally viewed as good, but not optimal. How do you figure out what your optimal levels for any lab result is and should be?
What I specifically was talking about was TSH, and the range was 0.5 to 2 for thyroid-stimulating hormone. And I mentioned 3.8 as a value that would be considered normal, but that I would consider high. As far as ideal reference ranges, there's a lot of places that you can find them. Dr. Mark Hyman has a pretty good downloadable free PDF on his website. Dr. Brian Walsh, who I mentioned during my presentation, most of his reference ranges are also very solid. If you go to just about any functional or integrated medical practitioner or somebody practicing precision medicine like these guys, they're using reference ranges that are a little bit more appropriate, in my opinion, for not just absence of disease, but actual health span.
Ben, you mentioned colostrum on your podcast. If you take colostrum on an empty stomach, my understanding is it won't raise your IGF. Is this correct or misunderstanding?
I've never heard that. I mean, you take a baby mammal, you give the colostrum, it grows. It's an anabolic. And I don't think that if it's on an empty stomach versus not, there's any difference. But there might be data I'm unaware of. Ultimately, colostrum is great for the gut. It's great if you've been on antibiotics. It's great if you have leaky gut. It's great if you're trying to put on muscle or increase growth factor or decrease inflammation in the gut. But I don't use it year-round just because it is such a potent IGF precursor that you don't want to stay in that constant state of anabolism.
So there's a lot of questions for Ben, so I've got one here for Mike. Mike, do you care to ask Ben what he thinks is the... So it's a question for anybody. So what is the ideal estradiol post-menopause, someone asked? We talked about estradiol levels being 30 to in the hundreds pre-menopausal, but then post-menopausal, someone asked that question. What about post-menopausal?
Ideal or physiologic?
So that's a great question. So physiologic, we know it should drop basically to zero. The debate is, then what do you do about that? Should you replace it? So you have some thoughts on that, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, we try to replace it back to basically pre-menopausal levels. We're trying to do HRT.
So there's so much kind of, I think, confusion around hormone replacement therapy and a lot of debate in general. The 2002 Women's Health Initiative study came out, and at that point, a large percentage of people were on hormone replacement therapy, and after that, it plummeted because the primary researcher in that study basically said it increases your chances for breast cancer and many other diseases. But on reanalysis by multiple other people, a lot of that's been called
into question. People who are actually involved in the primary study.
Even people who were involved in the primary study said there were a lot of problems with that study. So this is a really complicated question.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but that wasn't BHRT, was it?
That was just HRT, like
Premarin, you know, like horse urine.
And
bioidenticals, that study didn't take into account bioidenticals.
And there's some debate around Premarin versus bioidentical as well, but instead of giving you a 5-hour answer there. What I would recommend, and we'll give a short answer in our opinions on it here, is the book Estrogen Matters is a great entire book on the on that topic of hormone replacement therapy. That's a deep great dive. Big resource deep dive. If you want a 2 to 2.5 hour version, Peter T has a great podcast with the authors of that book. And that's a great summary as well. You can listen to it on 2x speed and it's a little over an hour. So you can get into those, but I think our general philosophy is that if it does increase risk for some things like breast cancer, heart disease, which is completely debatable, a lot of people say it decreases the risk for some of those things. That's all debatable. Even if it does increase it a tiny bit, maybe 1% or 2%, the quality of life that it gives women postmenopausal is probably worth that. So it's a complex question and answer between a patient and a clinician, and it's a lot of shared decision-making. How much is it going to increase or decrease my risk for these things? How much is it going to affect my quality of life? So it's a difficult question. We, in general, probably do replace hormones for women because it just adds a lot to the quality of life and may or may not increase or decrease certain risks based on all the studies that you look at. That's one study, the Women's Health Initiative. It's a big study, a lot of money behind it, a randomized placebo-controlled trial, but there are other studies that contradict it. So read that book, Estrogen Matters, if you want a much longer answer on that. But in general, we're not scared to replace hormones for women postmenopause. We think it really improves quality of life.
Plus, you can get horse hair pretty cheap around here. So.
Especially around here, yeah. How does this... Okay, this is a great question. I'll just ask it and then let you all dive in. How does a sense of spirituality and spiritual practice play into health and wellness? And I'm going to limit you all by maybe to 60 seconds each because that's such a big question. You have some summary thoughts on that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like we know that meditation and yoga and a lot of these things can actually change epigenetic expression. They can, you know, lower plasma cortisol. They can improve sleep cycles. And, you know, even stepping back and looking at it apart from the biological effects, we know they do, you know, like a gratitude practice will increase your level of empathy towards others. We know that in the blue zones, almost every single one has some prevalence of a belief in a higher power, some type of spiritual practice, and many of these spiritual practices are also tied into things like fasting and meditation and some type of a routine. So, in my opinion, the healthiest people on the face of the planet are people who are not only attentive to their mind and body, but also their spirit. And I think the spiritual disciplines cannot be emphasized enough.
You go through 4 years of medical school and you get zero, not just training, but zero thoughts on this in general. And it's such a disservice because it's a huge part of most people's life in general, growing up and then even after they're an adult. And it is extremely important. We for our patients, at least, we try to address this and we try to encourage it as much as possible. We don't push any certain religion or spiritual belief, but it can make a tremendous difference in health. And it's not just us saying that from an ancient standpoint, seeing it even in the blue zones, which is a great amount of evidence, but there's hard science behind this and what it does to your stress level and cortisol.
I can't summarize it any better than Matt didn't have, but I can tell you that just from a personal experience, like, finding a meditative practice and finding a mindfulness practice has been one of the most meaningful things I've done for my personal health in the last 10 years. It definitely feels, it changes the way that I view the world, the way that I interact with people, the way that I interact with my health.
I see patients in my clinic struggle up there with Alzheimer's, and people who have negative outlook on life, they don't do well. And basically, meditation will improve your outlook on life. And then that actually allows patients to improve. Sometimes this is a little thing that's missing. That's why they're not getting better. And with meditation and the spirituality, they actually are able to improve.
I think sometimes physicians, when they deliver bad news, they almost curse patients and tell them they have a certain amount of time to live or things like that.
Yeah.
That belief and that outlook.
I never tell patients that they will not recover, ever. That's my firm rule. But I don't know. I'm not a god. And nobody is. So if you tell a patient that he's not going to recover, he's not going to recover.
Okay, here's a question that I think Ben has multiple podcasts on. Mike and I have at least one we haven't even released yet. So we're going to. So here's what I'm going to do for this question. I'm going to have give you top three tips, and that's it. So the question was, you were talking about testosterone, free testosterone versus total levels of testosterone. Someone asked the question, how would you increase, you talked about a free percentage of testosterone being over 2%. If someone wanted to do that naturally, how would they increase their free testosterone?
Avoid heavy amounts of endurance exercise. And instead do brief spurts of high intensity interval training, heavy weightlifting. Oh, I think that kind of was three. That's an exercise tip. I would say optimize libido by prioritizing some type of regular sexual experience, like go out of your way to make sure that you're sending your body that signal, you know, at least on like a weekly basis that you're trying to maintain fertility, and that also helps keep your libido up, creates a positive feedback loop. And then I would say there's a third thing. It's that as you learn, bound testosterone is a lot of times not bioactive, especially if it's bound to sex hormone binding globulin, not healthy human. So one of the best things you can do is make sure that you control your cortisol and your stress so you're not upregulating SHBG.
Mike?
So I would say decrease insulin resistance. So best way to do that is to find exercise, we've already mentioned, but also to decrease simple carbohydrates in your diet and increase healthy fatty acids. That's going to decrease your insulin resistance and improve percentage of testosterone bound to sex hormone binding globulin, and also your testosterone production. And I can't say strength, that's my other favorite one. Let's see, Juvelite. Didn't mention Jude Light, definitely as proven by Mr. Phil, you can shine Jude Light on your testicles at night and work during the day or whenever you'd like and improve your testosterone production.
What is it, sleep yet?
Yeah, sleep. Well, I was trying to do something.
Well, basically stress, carbohydrates, or insulin resistance, and heavy lifting. If you can manage your stress, everything else actually will get better.
I think I've heard both you, Mike, and Ben talk about endurance. You've both done endurance events in the past. I have too, and the effect on testosterone as well. See, check that.
Well, lowest my testosterone has ever been was low fat diet with bodybuilding and racing.
And yeah, I think sleep is, yes.
Someone is asking about the research that's been done on the Juvelite, and here's Ben's answer.
There's some rodent model research on the activity of Leydig cells in the testes. All the human stuff is anecdotal, but anecdotal is anecdotal. It's still rife with examples. Like type of personal experience, you know, it helps quite a bit with not just testosterone, but also just general blood flow and general capillarization to your genitals. So,
yeah. Travis, there are some studies. If you email me, I'll send you those. I'll look them up. I've seen them and read them. I'll look them up and send them to you.
Right. And Ben, you also once mentioned that product that cools, like an ice pack.
There's some company called Primal Jet Pack that makes an ice pack literally designed to cool the balls and increase testosterone via that method, which is kind of funny because you get it and it's just like a regular old ice pack, but it says for your balls. I'm sure their margins are great on that.
the fancy ice we have here works.
We have small, medium, and large.
If it has a castle stamp on it, like our fancy ice, it's 3 minutes more twice as well.
All right, folks, clinical research has shown that therapeutically and for overall health and well-being, the most critical time to ground is when you sleep. The electrons you absorb when grounding neutralizes free radical damage, squelches inflammation, restores healthy endocrine function, enhances cellular gating and circulation. That then improves the cellular uptake of nutrients and oxygen and hormones while maximizing the removal of cellular waste. And you can now ground when you sleep. This company called Ultimate Longevity makes indoor grounded sleeping devices, and they've done clinical research studies on grounding the human body for health. When you sleep on these mats, you get 6 to 8 hours of uninterrupted grounding, meaning I could travel, unroll it onto my hotel room bed, and fight all of the radiation, the inflammation I got from flying in the airplane right there during a full night of sleep.
Full body grounding, which is what these mats give you, versus just your feet on the ground, maximizes the electron transfer, because the more surface area contact, the more beneficial the electrons, the more the results. So you get these amazing benefits. And inside your body, this stream of electrons works as an anti-inflammatory, pain-relieving, anti-aging, antioxidant boost, squelching inflammation all night long. They've got over 20 peer-reviewed research studies that have been published on the extensive health benefits of grounding. For vagal tone, serum electrolytes, thyroid function, blood glucose, blood viscosity, sleep, pain, stiffness, blood pressure, stress, even depression and anxiety. It's crazy. So you can go to ultimatelongevity.com/Ben to get your hands on these grounding mats. You can do mattress, pillow, blankets, a whole bunch of other valuable tools to help you bring your inflammation down and jumpstart your healing process. Again, it's ultimatelongevity.com/Ben. Well, folks, you and I, or the average American at least, spend an average of 90% of time indoors, breathing around 30,000 gallons of air daily. According to the EPA, indoor air can be 2 to 5 times more polluted than outdoor air, and in some cases, 100 times more polluted, especially like your home gym where you're breathing in even more air. This can be a serious issue. Data shows that air pollution is responsible for nearly 7 million premature deaths around the world. So you need air purifying technology, and the one that I like as a standalone system that doesn't require you to go re-outfit your entire home's AC system or ducts is called the Air Doctor. The Air Doctor filters out dangerous contaminants and allergens like pollen, pet dander, dust mites, and mold, so your lungs don't need to. Their Ultra HEPA filter has been independently tested to remove 99.99% of tested bacteria and viruses and virtually 100% of particles as small as 0.003 microns. They also feature whisper jet fans, 30% quieter than normal ordinary air purifiers, and they are extremely affordable and accessible. Furthermore, they're going to give you up to 39% off of one of their extremely impressive and efficacious air filters, or up to $300 off today. Here's how you lock this in. You go to airdoctorpro.com/BenG. You can get one with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund, minus shipping, but you're going to love it. airdoctorpro.com/BenG. You'll get up to 39% off, or up to $300 off. So lock it in today, folks. You'll enjoy it. Clean air is something everybody deserves. You can get it with the Air Doctor.
Someone asked about ashwagandha. How does ashwagandha play a role in cortisol and other adaptogens? Anybody want to take that one?
It's pretty simple. How adaptogenic herb works. It's going to increase cortisol when it's low and help to decrease it when it's high. That's generally how adaptogen works. Is it adapts to the state that your body is in. That's why, you know, reishi mushroom extract puts some people to sleep and gives some people great amounts of energy. You know, just depends on what your body needs at the time.
And I was always, the adaptogens, they never quite made sense to me. It's kind of hard to wrap your mind around that. But things like chaga, ginseng, ashwagandha, great adaptogens. This person is specifically asking, how does it play a role in cortisol? I don't know if we fully understand. You look, there's some studies in rats where they look at ashwagandha and it shuts down some stress mechanisms and pathways in the brain. And so that probably is how they're working. But regardless of how they're working, it does seem to have a positive effect on cortisol. So adaptogens like mushrooms, some of those superfood mushrooms, ginseng, ashwagandha are great. Do you have anything to add?
Everybody responds differently. Some people respond to rhodiola better. Some people respond to ashwagandha better. For example, I don't really feel anything, any effects of ashwagandha. At the same time, if I'll take a rhodiola, I can go exercise for an hour.
You said rhodiola?
Rhodiola, yeah. So, but I think I've seen some information why that means, but I cannot recall.
Yeah. Dr. Sean Talbot, T-A-L-B-O-T-T, he's got some really good online resources and a good book on the exact mechanism of action of a lot of different adaptogens. So take a deep dive into his work.
Here's an interesting question. How long would a dietary change take to see a change in the omega-3 index? We're talking about omega-3 index. We normally like to see above 8 in our patients. If you're not going to take, I guess we can include just omega-3 supplement. If it's a dietary change or a supplement, how long have you had an experience?
Within 3 months, you'll see. If you'll eat a lot of fish and very low omega-6s, within 3 months, you will change your omega
Well, that's pretty exact.
It's going to be different from person to person, though, because it depends on how long your red blood cells stay in your system and how quickly you clear. But I think 3 months is a good rule. Maybe four. To truly change over the cell architecture in the brain could take longer, is my understanding.
Right. Well, on testing.
Or a year, yeah. But for testing, if serum testing, you know, we're looking at RBC turnover, so that would be, 120 days or less.
And the fish, the dietary changes you should do, I think you all probably all know the acronym SMASH fish. Those are great fish. If you want to just do a pure dietary instead of actually adding a supplement, SMASH fish, would think of sardines, mackerel, these are cold water fish. It's the bottom of the food chain, so they're not predators. We've got some bioaccumulation of some heavy metals. Sardines, mackerel, anchovy, salmon, and herring. Those are great choices if you just want to look for things that, like the salmon we have today. Salmon we had today was from a very specific region too. So salmon wild versus farm can be different. So the quality of the source of your fish, your dietary change, or your supplement also makes a big difference. So omega-3s, I think sometimes people can fall into a trap, and if they just get a cheap omega-3, they could potentially do more damage than good. So it's important to think about the quality of your source.
That's an extremely important point. You can get oxidation of these omega-3s fairly easily. So not only buying a quality one, but also taking care of it, not leaving it out in the sun, potentially putting it in the freezer, the fridge.
Yeah. I'd throw, I don't know if this kind of F's up the SMASH algorithm, but I'd throw roe and krill oil in there too. So SMASH or K, I think is what that would be.
So Chris Smasho.
SMASH or K.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. It's kind of Russian.
It is very important to realize that omega-6 is also required for our body. Omega-9s are required for our body. So a lot of people say, I'll eat only fish, I'm not going to eat any omega-6s. And then when I look at their blood chemistries, they have very large amount of omega-6s, they have very low omega-3s, they have very low omega-6s, and then the body that cannot work. Your cell requires all three of them to function correctly.
And we don't always talk about that because just in the standard American diet, people tend to get a lot of
right.
Have you actually seen people go too far?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's really impressive.
I've seen a couple of patients who are really, really dedicated, eating a lot of fish oil. Their omega-3s were out of the chart, yeah. Off the chart, and the omega-6s were really low.
Practically have to not eat out, not go to
correct.
House.
Yeah.
It's so hard to not get omega-6s.
But honestly, though, the group we have here, the questions I've gotten, this could be a group that could be so orthorexic. It's an important point.
Yeah. Major component of mitochondrial membrane called cardiolipin depends on a certain amount of these so-called parent essential oils, which you're going to get from, borage seed oil, primrose oil, hemp, flax, chia, and you don't want to completely neglect including those.
So, CGM device, a continuous glucose monitor. Man's got one on. As far as commercially available CGM devices, do you all have any recommendations in general?
There's only one that is
the Dexcom.
There's one called the Freestyle Libre a lot of people use, but I've used it. The accuracy is very questionable. I like the Dexcom series. Dexcom G6 is gold standard.
Is anybody here one-on-one or have one on now? You do?
I wear the G6 and I was asking him because I've always worn it on the belly because that's what they recommend. And so I'm glad to see that it's just as accurate on the arm because it's a much more convenient.
Yeah, I wear it on the arm. I get the skin patches from Amazon that allow it to stay down a little bit more. And then I also put on top of that a special a skin adhesive. So I generally don't have any issues. When I wear my belly, squats, deadlifts, anything like that, it just rubs and I don't like it.
Well, what I found shocking is how easily insurance covers it. I mean, there was no question, no eye blink, nothing. And I guess Dexcom's doing a good job.
So we were talking about that earlier today, so I'm glad you brought that up. What did you have to have your insurance covered? Because if you were to just buy this cash price for a year, cost close to $5,000 for all the monitoring and the sensors and things like that.
So I guess I still am, because I will forever be a type 2 diabetic at the time. But, my doctor just wrote a prescription for continuous monitor. I told my pharmacist which brand I wanted. And, I was shocked because, I reimbursement is my world. I'm a nurse, but reimbursement is the world I work in. And it was shocking to me that it's
there's not a whole lot of red tape right now. I don't know if it will be if more patients are kind of getting on to them and they're seeing the cost, and maybe that's going to change in the next year. But it's just, there is a learning curve on how it needs to be written, because the transmitter on the desktop has to be replaced every 3 months. The sensors, you know, they're 3 every month. And so that's the only learning curve I see, is how it needs to be written from a prescription standpoint.
I guess so. That's so, if you actually have a diagnosis of diabetes, the insurance is usually pretty good because there's so many complications with that. If you didn't have it, you just wanted to monitor, like Ben, then you get into kind of a tricky issue, because if we were, Mike and I, we have some of these ordered for our patients. Someone that has really difficult insulin resistance, it's probably good, even if they don't have diabetes, for a few months to see how they respond to food or cold plunge, like Ben was just showing us what happens to the glucose after a cold plunge. If you just wanted to do that, it's difficult. It's expensive. And if you were to put diabetes on someone's chart, it may affect some long-term care insurance, some other health insurance issues. So if anybody, does anybody have any ideas on how to maybe, no, it's just cash or the diagnosis yet? We haven't figured out anything.
I will say Costco, I read an article that Costco's made a deal with Dexcom to where their cash price is much lower than anywhere else for cash. It's still not cheap. But he wore mine for a while because I had to change transmitters. So there's like a 2-week period where the old transmitter worked. And so just to kind of see for 10 days with him, you know, we did that. But
buddy system.
Exactly.
Eat a lot of M&Ms and cream ones, go to your doc, that's what they said.
But I don't think it's worth having that diagnosis on your chart. Just for
So... question from, you're talking about IGF testing. Someone asked, when is it optimal to test IGF-1? Day after a hard workout or fasting or yoga or all of those, and then kind of take the media?
I believe the gold standard for IGF-1 is a fast blood. You guys might know more than me,
gold standard.
Pretty sure it's fast.
I think there's some benefits in knowing the range. You know, in terms of trying to capture something higher, like an anabolic state versus a catabolic state. So if you are gonna get into that, that would be interesting to know. From my experience, typically it tracks fairly well with insulin resistance. So the higher your insulin, the higher your IGF-1 is. So in most patients, I don't have too much concern unless they've got elevated. But in that case, it could be interesting to look at both the catabolic and anabolic state.
Going along the lines of testing time, so should the microbiome test be done at a certain time of day without exercise, prior to exercise? Does anything like that affect the microbiome status?
Well, microbiome changes really fast, but typically it just doesn't once.
Oh, so we have our PhD nutritionist and expert in microbiome, Sarah, here. Do you have any thoughts on the microbiome, how quickly that kind of changes in testing in general?
So if you're going to test it, and I hope that we figure out like the specifics around the testing and how useful that is and how to tweak the microbiome to improve health outcomes, that it be consistently, right? Whether it's first thing in the morning, at the end of the day, or for a woman, like the same time within the cycle.
Theoretically, the bacteria are more active in the morning than at night, right? I mean, we know the bacteria have circadian rhythm. I think you actually taught me that. So I guess it would make more sense to test it during the day than last meal.
Most of the research on microbiome response to exercise is chronic, not acute. So I doubt that you having done a hard workout versus an easy workout the day prior or even immediately prior to the test is going to change that much.
And to be honest, you all can correct me if you disagree, but I mean, when I look at the data on exercise and athletes and microbiome, I'm having a hard time sorting out what is like causal and what's correlation, which comes first, exercise or the microbiome. And so I'm not sure exactly how much it matters when you test, but the safest thing is just to test same time. And I doubt you're going to be doing a lot of testing. I mean, it's $300 or so per time, so you're probably not going to test multiple times over the course of a month. But if you're going to test every few months, if you've got a specific thing you're trying to change, like for us, if you're deficient in vitamin B6, we know that's produced by certain microbes in your gut, and so if you're trying to correct that and you're testing every few months, it makes sense to test during the same time and in similar conditions in my mind. But I've got exactly zero science to back that up, but it makes sense to test at the same time. Yes.
How about supplementation prior to? So if you're checking magnesium or B vitamins, the day before the test, if you normally take magnesium at night or B vitamins in the morning or whatever, should you not take the supplement for a day or two before the test?
It's better coming in 4 days.
4 days. Stop the supplement.
Yeah, Nutrival and Spectracell, they all recommend 4 days.
These are great questions. These are difficult questions. And a lot of, just to be super clear, I mean, like, I just want to point out, a lot of these questions, the answers we're giving you are our opinions, and they're us kind of taking all the research we've read and kind of making some educated guesses. So I don't want to confuse this with hard science and randomized double placebo-controlled trials, but these are kind of our opinions based on our reading of the literature. Okay, so here's a question. We were talking about parasites. Someone said, my understanding is it's difficult to test for parasites since they release an enzyme once the stool hits the air, and this enzyme dissolves the parasites. Is this correct? You all heard of this? I've not heard of that.
I think that's why you put it in the reservative, by the way. Yeah.
What was your answer?
I think when you do the 3-day GI effects, you put it in a preservative right away, and then you freeze it.
Yeah, that tube. So it's not going anywhere.
Preservative
in. So just do it really quickly.
Well, that's what you're supposed to do.
Follow the test instructions, and right. That preserves it.
I just heard that the needle that it dissolves it, so I just didn't know. And it's interesting because probably 95% of our patients come back and they have no parasites, and I'm like, there's no way. And then we do a parasite cleanse, and they're releasing tapeworms and roundworms, and so I'm just wondering if the validity of that. But besides that, did you ask?
Do you do one day or do you do 3-day tests?
3-day always.
Really?
Yeah, always. Okay. Yeah, it's the same price. But so, I like the test for so many other reasons because it gives you so much information.
Right.
I just find it interesting that so many people don't have parasites, but yet when we put them on a parasite cleanse, you know, within 9 days they start releasing parasites. So
it's a great observation. I mean, every test that we do in medicine, I think a lot of times people think about tests being similar to a pregnancy test, like it's a positive or negative, close to 100% sensitivity and specificity, but very few tests that we do really have those operating characteristics, and they have sensitivities and specificities that are all over the place. So it's a very valid when you make that observation to at least think about that and keep that in mind. So it's a good point. Okay, here's one that we could talk for a long time on because I think we have multiple podcasts on this. So again, top three tips here. I'm going to limit you all to. What are key factors to getting quality deep sleep? You said deep sleep, so let's specify deep sleep.
Well, I think Ben has a phenomenal article on this. I think he covered pretty much everything.
Yeah, there's a 10,000 word article on my website I published last week. If you go to my website, do a search for deep sleep. There's like half a dozen other articles on it. Top three, I think would be cold. Like making sure you're sleeping in a cold environment and even lowering the core temp prior to bed, not eating a heavy meal right before you hit the sack. Number two, I found, we talked about this on the podcast yesterday, it hasn't been released yet, but higher amounts of CBD oil. So you can talk about quite a bit, or a CBD supplement, like in the range of 60 to 100 milligrams of CBD. And let me think, probably a third, I would say. I mean, if you have like some good comfortable sleep phones or headphones, any of these kind of binaural beats that are designed for deep sleep, those help me out quite a bit. So those are really three.
Hey Ben, what kind of headphones are you talking about?
There's a company called Sleep Phones.
I saw that. Isn't it required cord to go to your phone?
Yeah.
Okay. I was just looking for some Bluetooth or something.
I wouldn't be wearing Bluetooth on your head all night.
Yeah, just sleeping over it.
Yeah.
Okay, you can go to airplane mode if you're going to
Try cold phones. They have a separate CD for sleep. And I found it's very, very useful. Listen for about 20, 30 minutes.
Plug it into a CD player.
Yeah, you plug it in and then you put it inside and sleep.
Okay.
Yeah, it's very helpful.
Thanks.
Whole bones? Whole
tones. Yeah. That same guy, the composer for that, says you gotta go don't wear headphones, you have a speaker on the other side of the bed to get a similar effect.
I was just gonna say a regular exercise routine, I think, is important to optimize your deep sleep, as well as avoiding alcohol. I think it's extremely important.
Except
Nobody's sleeping at night. Nobody's looking at their aura tomorrow.
And then I think, you know, Ben mentioned it briefly, but I think there's something definitely to be said for a fasted period prior to bedtime, preferably greater than 3 to 4 hours. Actually, the longer you can make that period, the better. I think the one problem with the intermittent fasting phase is that everyone's pushing their feeding time to later in the day, when realistically, in order to optimize sleep, in order to optimize insulin resistance and your circadian rhythm, you should be pushing it to earlier in the day. So you should wake up, it's bright outside, you should eat, and then you should stop eating sooner in the day, fast during the evening. Realistically, that's harder to do socially with family and everything like that. But in terms of deep sleep, in terms of insulin resistance, in terms of your circadian rhythm, all of those things are benefited significantly by a longer fasting period prior to sleep.
Also realize that there are different reasons why people not sleeping. So you kind of really need to address that. A lot of people have a lot of anxiety and stress. And I found valerian root and chamomile tea would be just perfectly covering them. At the same time, if they have stronger issues, if they have some significant problems, then CBD oil would be fine. Also, again, sleep hygiene is very, very important. There's no question about it.
Some people have, you know, melatonin and cortisol balances that need to be addressed. There's tons of different reasons you don't sleep. It's a huge aspect of your life, just like cardiovascular disease. There's not a single pill that we can give you to reduce your risk, just same with sleep. There's not a single thing that we can tell you that's going to improve your sleep.
And then we have not talked about it this time, but blue lights are destroying your melatonin. So you really need to have blue blockers after sunset to allow your melatonin to build up. And if you chronically have been really poisoned by blue light, then it will take some time for your melatonin to build up.
Do you find those patients that are low carb or ketogenic have deficiencies in magnesium? So any other questions out here too, but I guess this is kind of an experience question. You find people on a low-carb or ketogenic diet are deficient in magnesium. Now, I'll kind of read in a little bit of this question. I'm assuming the person asking this is thinking, okay, leafy greens are really high in magnesium, a lot of vegetables are high in magnesium, so.
Well, it depends on what kind of ketogenic diet you eat. If you eat bacon and eggs and meat, then you probably will be. At the same time, if you're getting really high plant-based ketogenic diet, then probably not.
Ben's going to walk around and take food out of everybody's
study. That's a little dessert that you guys are banging things out up there.
I don't really know what to say. I
mean, magnesium, I mean, you get in liver, organ meats, there are a lot of great sources of magnesium that aren't plant-based at all. So in my experience, I haven't seen that at all, low magnesium. Has anybody seen that? The person who asked that question, is that an experience that you've had? I'm sure to ask.
No, what I've seen more is that people don't have enough folic acid to break the mineral bonds of hot, you know, parts of the vegetables that they're eating. So you've got to fix their digestion too, right?
Gotcha. So you're saying so more of a digestion issue,
yeah,
of absorbing the magnesium.
I mean,
yeah, I think one of the issues too is that glycogen carries a certain amount of electrolytes in water, and so once you dump a lot of glycogen, you can dump a lot of minerals, and people get keto flu, et cetera, and that actually can be helped quite a bit with electrolyte supplementation. So all your minerals, not just magnesium, but they all take a little bit of a hit and dump that glycogen.
Yeah, we have a patient right now who's been emailing on refill protocol and having some issues with kind of cramps at nights and things, emailing to start a ketogenic diet. And my assumption, we're trying to correct right now, is that it was more related to the glycogen depletion, some dehydration, maybe some minerals, so the supplementing with magnesium, but it was really probably more dehydration than anything else. Chris, did you say you have patients where you've seen that?
No, I asked the question. I was just curious. Yeah, that's good.
Along those same lines, we use a lot of no salt, which is potassium chloride, along with sea salt as a supplement in our water. I haven't really seen a lot of Dr. Barry was the one that recommended that. I haven't seen that many other places. Is there harm in using no salt?
Potassium chloride specifically.
Yeah, it's all it is potassium chloride. And so you cannot even begin to scratch the surface if you buy a potassium supplement with the amount of levels that's in no salt, which is a huge amount. And so we dump, you know, a quarter teaspoon of that in water, and it seems to really make a big difference for energy level. But I also want to make sure that, you know, we're not doing something that's harmful. Because I recommend it to, everybody that I work with if they're doing the keto diet.
I mean, someone has good renal function. I mean, it's a water-soluble thing. Your body's going to handle
that. Just as potassium. That's all it is.
Those were incredible questions. You'll probably have more. What other questions? Yeah, we're like total geeks about this stuff. We love talking about it. So what other questions do you have? And do you have any specific comments on the things that we said you may disagree with or seem contradictory evidence? Because my favorite thing in the world is to be wrong, because that's when we're learning. So, any other? Yeah.
Here, someone is asking Ben about some comments that he made recently about having high cortisol metabolism and what he's doing about that if he's following a ketogenic diet.
I haven't followed a strict ketogenic diet for years. I have a pretty simple protocol. I just don't eat many carbohydrates at all until the very end of the day. I do a carb refeed at the end of the day. Restores my glycogen levels for the next day's workout. I test my ketones. Usually takes a couple hours for me to kind of get back into ketosis, and that works well for me. I have some clients I coach who aren't as physically active for me. Sometimes they just have like a Saturday or a Sunday where they're doing most of their carbs on just that one day and staying in a pretty steady ketosis otherwise. But it all depends on activity levels to a certain extent.
Is there any merit to the low carb causing HPAS absorption or adrenal fatigue?
Sure. I mean, any highly restrictive or myopic diet, I think, can cause some HPA axis issues. I mean, honestly, on two levels. Number one, stress about eating, having a more direct approach to diet. And then B, the glucose deprivation, to a certain extent, we just touched on a lot of the electrolyte depletion can occur as a result of that.
I think it's good you said, you talked about what you did, but then you talked about what some of your clients did, because it's important to note that nobody else has been greenfield. Like, so his diet that works perfect for him is not going to be for everybody. It's a great experience, but we all have to think about your activity level compared to a pro Spartan racer. It's going to be different for everybody. It's a great guideline, but it's good to have a guide or at least be testing, like all these things have been talked about before, to really measure yourself and figure out what works best for you as well.
Someone is now asking about a colonoscopy, if that's the best way to reset the microbiome.
I don't think it wipes it out. I mean, unless you take antibiotics, your bugs are well there.
They're in what's called a biofilm. So if you've ever had like a really dirty dish, you know that that you have to scrub the hell out of it to get the crap off. That's sort of a biofilm, right? So bugs in your colon, Sarah's looking at that. The bugs in your colon are basically inside of a biofilm, and as that whatever the specific thing you're taking is, whether it's a
Max Citrate
or whatever the giant gallon of whatever it is, that is not going to dissolve the biofilm. So it's not a surfactant is what I'm getting at. It is going to basically clean up all the large pieces of poo. Leave the biofilm just happy as ever. You shouldn't have any.
I have pretty significant microbial diversity. I do a coffee enema 1 to 2 times a week. When I travel, a lot of times I'll do like a glycerol enema if I've got traveler's constipation or anything like that. Zero issues with microbial diversity. If you were concerned about that, I mean, it's pretty simple to actually do a probiotic enema. I mean, you can take probiotics, put it in coconut water, let it ferment for about 6 hours, and literally just infuse and hang out upside down for about 20 minutes or in some kind of inverted position. You can actually do a little bit of a colonic repopulation using that approach.
I just saw someone mouth, oh my God, when you said that.
Fun with your butt.
I have a two-part question. Maybe even three-part. So what would you do for a patient who gets the common cold, and is it personalized based off of their DNA and their blood and all that, or is it, if you have a common cold, here's what you need to eat and supplement with, or medicine, medicine is the first part, and then the first two parts of this. Third part is, if it develops into an ear infection or a sinus infection or a bronchial, whatever, how do you naturally heal it without antibiotics?
So common cold usually is a viral infection. It's self-limited. Should get better. If you want to support your system in general, there are so many things we can talk about. This is about supporting your immune system with adaptogens, like we talked about, chaga, vitamin C. A lot of medical doctors may poo-poo that, but there's pretty good evidence on high-dose vitamin C. For myself personally, if I wake up with my ordering data, my HRV down in the 40s and my resting heart rate is in the 50s, I know if I don't feel bad, I'm going to be feeling bad.
And your temperature. Your temperature. Checks your temperature.
I'm going to take a lot of vitamin C, and I'm going to just, simple thing, rest. Take it easy. Don't stress your body out. It's telling you it's going to be busy fighting this off, so you're going to give us some time and some support. That would be my general advice on just wellness. I mean, sleep, rest.
Taking
any,
I think there's
any
reason not to take
any
antioxidants, vitamin C. I mean,
I have a protocol that I basically take 30,000 units of vitamin C. I take at least 1 or 2 grams of vitamin C, and specifically vitamin C, it's important vitamin C. L-ascorbate, not ascorbate. Then I do chaga, then I do sauna, and I hydrate myself like that. And typically within a day or so, well, I go to work. Within a day or so, I get there.
You go to work, I'll give everybody else the
comment. Yeah, that's right. Chaga, sauna, electrolytes, vitamin D, vitamin C, all of those are spot on. The only other ones I'd throw in there that I've found to be very effective would be zinc acetate lozenges, like dissolving those so that you get some of that intranasal absorption, like 4 to 6 of those lozenges per day. Bee propolis, which is very, very effective, and then finally oil of oregano. So I know it's a lot of stuff, but I would say those would be the biggies I've found in terms of the home first aid kit for colds and flus.
Can you ask me?
I was just going to go ahead and the antibiotic question.
Yeah, so, let me ask.
The data is convincing that antibiotics for sinusitis and ear infections has virtually no benefit. The majority of sinusitis is not bacterial-based, it's viral-based in the first place, and antibiotics are not associated with anything. If anything, for ear infections, antibiotics might decrease the symptoms by about 12 hours, and when you compare that to the risk of your gut and altering your microbiome and causing dysbiosis, I don't think that's worth a lot. In fact, my son just had bilateral ear infections. I fought tooth and nail to not perform antibiotics because I think it's extremely low value.
And Mike, he said there's no benefit. He also talked about a little benefit about the 12 hours. So it's important to talk about risk and benefit. Like if it's a few hours of symptom relief, you have to compare that to the problems that it causes. You go to, there's a great website called dnng.com, the number to treat.com. So it talks about the small benefit for antibiotics for maybe ear infection or sinusitis or even strep pharyngitis. And it talks about the downside and the number of the harm also. So even though maybe you get a little benefit from those things, the harm that you get is much greater.
Let's also be clear, too, that there are times for antibiotics. While we spend a lot of our time talking about how bad antibiotics are for you, sometimes patients have to be on antibiotics or they're going to die.
They save millions of lives.
It's extremely important. The problem is the pendulum has swung all the way towards antibiotics for convenience of providers and patient comfort, and it doesn't have enough conversation in it about what are the risks and benefits of taking the medication.
Yeah, it could be placebo, but I've had infections for weeks, and then I get on an antibiotic, and I'm cured like in a day or two. It's like almost, I don't, it's just...
It's a valid experience. But if you look at all the data would suggest if you look at all the big meta-analyses, things like ear infection, it may reduce like the symptoms from like 5 days to 4 3/4 days. Mike said 12 hours and stuff. I said like 6 hours. Like it's a really small window that it actually helps. And what happens a lot of times too is people try to hold off, and they think it's late when it's kind of getting better already. So.
That's not to say that you didn't have a valid experience or that antibiotics didn't necessarily improve your experience. It is definitely patient-dependent and a situation.
And the problem with your experience is that also there's a time is the issue. So you may have a little bit of benefit. What you may not have associated with antibiotics is if you take one course of antibiotics, your chance of having anxiety and depression next year increases by 17-24%. Two courses increases by 40-45%. So if you felt anxious 6 months later, you're not associating that with antibiotics. So you're not incorporating that part of the experience into the equation. So a lot of the problems from something like antibiotics are going to be temporally unrelated to when you take them. So that's why the studies on these things are important too, things about not just the experience.
The best way to prevent colds is to take cold showers every morning. I swear by it, I have not had a cold for 3 years since I started doing that.
So 3 years.
and water here is very, very cold.
It's pretty dang good tip. I travel a good 2 to 3 weeks out of every month. I'm on the road all over the place. I'm rarely sick. Like but two times in the past 5 years, and I'm cold shower morning and off evening too.
See, I love my hot showers, but it killed me with Matthew when we're getting ready to close the pool. He's out there, and I'm like, good God, he's out there, it's freezing cold. He's out there with his little elastic things on, swimming against the current. I'm thinking, I would have already been frozen. But it's funny to me because I had a cold right before Christmas, and for those who don't know, I work for the Kentucky Castle, and I'm very busy. So I did not have time to get sick. I have a very low immune system, so sometimes I feel like I always take antibiotics to prevent, but I also have chronic bronchitis. So it's like I can go through a sinus infection, but I can have bronchitis for 3 to 6 months. I'm still coughing from my last one. So I go to Matthew to tell him, you know, I'm getting sick, da-da-da-da-da. Take, you know, this amount of vitamin C. That's not what I wanted to hear. I need a prescription pad thing. Let me get an antibiotic, get a shot. Let's kill this now. And so I do the vitamin C. But I will say that it worked, and I felt better without having to go through the whole, you know. But I will say I was against it at first. And yes, it did. I didn't have to go to the doctor and go through the whole rigmarole. This antibiotic or a steroid dose pack or anything like that. I just had to do, as Matthew said, as long as your stomach can handle taking it, do it. So.
But it
works.
You
had a question, Jim? I did. So, whenever I feel like I'm getting sick and I'm lucky, I've never had the flu, I get sinus infections, and I get strep throat. I mean, if someone in this room has strep throat, I'm going to get it. Again, it's one of these people. But I try to fight it with my own immune system beforehand and, like, take certain vitamins, make my tea, everything. But you say, like, sometimes you do need an antibiotic. And I guess I'm asking in what certain circumstances, as an individual who doesn't want to take an antibiotic, should think, okay, maybe I should go.
Well, you need to work on your immune system now when you don't have strep throat. If you have strep throat, it's actually better to take antibiotic because there are so many complications related to strep throat, including myocarditis, including potentially meningitis. You don't want that. That's kind of bad.
So is that a certain
So just work on your immune system now.
I haven't had it in years, but that's just an example of something that I do tend to catch if someone nearby has it. So I guess what I'm asking is, in what circumstances should you say, okay, I should go see someone for an antibiotic as opposed to trying to take care of this myself?
Yeah, that's difficult, yeah. When exactly, I mean, every situation is so different. I don't think there's any certain thing that, like, okay, now I'll go see somebody. If it's someone who you trust and you trust their opinion, I think you can go see them.
Then have that discussion.
Thank God I work for you. I'm just asking you. Yeah, I'll say, like, with our pediatrician for my 8-year-old, we've seen her since he was 2. And I told her on the front end, if I bring him in, I don't need to walk out of here with a prescription to feel like I have value in my business. And I think that's important for all of us, for whoever we go to see, is because I think there's a lot of parents that feel like they wasted their time if they go to the pediatrician and they have a sick kid and they don't walk out with a prescription. That I know I can trust if I do walk out, like maybe 4 times my son has had an antibiotic in his 8 years. And I know that those 4 times he needed it versus the other times she's like, yeah, it's going to last you up to 2 weeks. And sure enough, on that 2 week mark, that fever stops and you move along.
Yeah, it's great to communicate that with your physicians. You're not expecting a prescription. That takes a lot off of their shoulders, and they know they can have an honest discussion with you about whether it's needed or not.
This is a question regarding how to deal with fainting episodes that are related to stress. Best ways to deal with those, or to prevent them.
I've come at it from the standpoint of improving vagal nerve tone, and there are a variety of methods used to do that. You know, there are devices like vagal nerve stimulators, you know, like the Fisher-Wallace Circadia or the Newcomb device or, you know, the David Delight Pro or any of these light sound therapy devices that assist with vagal nerve tone. Also, practices that we've traditionally been used to manage stress can help. Chanting, singing, humming, meditation, yoga, cold exposure, particularly cold water, face dumps can help out quite a bit. There's a lot that you can do to improve vagal nerve tone. I have a podcast called 32 Ways to Stimulate Your Vagal Nerve, which I cover a lot of that stuff. But I think one of the biggest ones, actually, so you can kill 2 birds with 1 stone, you know, as the doc over here alluded to, you know, for the immune system with cold exposure, you know, getting your face underwater, doing like a cold water face dump or a cold shower every day can really help with vagal nerve tone. As a matter of fact, that's one of my top ways to improve heart rate variability, which is daily cold exposure.
Now, you all talk a lot about the chaga. What about the kombucha and sauerkraut? Is that a really good way, to, without the testing, to add to the probiotic?
So actually on the back table there is sauerkraut for you all to take as a gift. So today has been a packed day. What I plan to do with each meal is I wanted to actually go over some of the foods that we were eating and talk about the nutrient density and what they do for you. And we didn't do that because we've had so many. We had to learn about bourbon, so we had a busy day. So we had to do some sauerkraut back there. But that's a great way to add to improve your microbiome.
Yeah, very convenient. Sauerkraut's excellent. Kombucha, I think the evidence is a little less convincing, but it's still, I mean, a very low risk.
And even without the testing that you're talking about that we need to do, I mean, it's beneficial to eat that and drink that kombucha.
It can be. It depends. Like if you have yeast or fungal issues, if you have mold and mycotoxin sensitivity, you can have a pretty pronounced histamine response to a lot of those foods. I feel pretty good on some foods like sauerkraut and kefir and kimchi. I feel like crap when I drink a lot of kombucha. So many of these ferments you have to experiment with and pay attention to the way that your body feels. And in my opinion, if you do have any issues with some type of bacterial overgrowth, sometimes the cons outweigh the pros. Same can be said for either a genetic-based histamine intolerance or a histamine sensitivity brought on by mold and mycotoxin exposure. So it's kind of a deep rabbit hole. You know, ferments, I think, sometimes get put on a pedestal, and a lot of people use them and wind up feeling worse on them. So, you know, there are some people that just have to use like a probiotic strain, like a probiotic supplement that's a non-histamine-producing probiotic, or they need to just use, say, like a dairy-based ferment or a non-kombucha-based ferment. Like, you know, there are so many bacteria in a lot of these compounds. You do need to pay attention to the way your body feels and symptoms when you begin to use them.
I struggle with a lot of joint pain and so forth, and I started doing the kombucha regularly, but it didn't seem to really affect that much. And that's the reason I was curious.
Like, there's a lot more that goes into your microbiome health than just probiotics. There's also prebiotics. There's, you know, this concept of, is there any dysbiosis? That sort of stuff doesn't change overnight, and sometimes it does take, you know, really aggressive prebiotic administration or probiotic administration sometimes to change that. And also lifestyle factors as well can change it. So there's just so much that goes into it. I mean, I think it's hard to, you know, it'd be great if you could just drink kombucha and feel better. But, I mean, if your inflammation is truly coming from your gut, it may take a little bit of a deeper dive to figure out what it is.
And as we said a few times, your experience is valid. Do the testing, read the science, try to make good, educated decisions. But if something that agrees with you doesn't agree with you, it's good information. Yeah, I did great with kombucha. I crave kombucha frequently. It does something good for me. And so if it doesn't for you, then...
I love it. I just can't tell that I've got beneficial results.
Drink it because you love
it. It's a very valid reason to drink it as well.
Now a gentleman is asking the panel their thoughts on a 5-day fasting mimicking diet versus a 3-day water fast.
The great thing about the fasting mimicking diet is there's good science behind it. So we can't argue with those results in that science. 3-day water fast, I think, is really great as well, but that's hard. That's difficult. I think if you can do that, you're a physician. So if you're doing that and you're kind of monitoring and watching yourself, I think that's a great way to really stimulate some massive autophagy and get some good benefits from it as well.
I don't think it's clear, though, that there's more autophagy with one than the other. I mean, we don't really truly know how to measure autophagy, so we have to sort of estimate it. My best guess in terms of estimation is looking at ketones. If you're coming from a non-ketotic state, going into a ketotic state secondary to fasting, then if I were you and you're trying to decide between the two, if one doesn't necessarily feel a lot better, then I would look at your ketone response over, you know, a couple of different fasts in either direction, see when you have the ketone response the fastest and how deep you go into ketosis, because that's probably our best, in my opinion, surrogate for autophagy outside of another measurement at this point.
Just measure. And we're all different. That's why they have precision medicine. You have to measure your response. What works for me, what works for them, does not work for you. And vice versa. You have to measure yourself, and you need to figure out where you are in that spectrum.
And it depends on your goals as a person, too. So, like, my father and I, we are both going to do a fasting protocol and try to stimulate autophagy. I'm probably going to be more of a fasting mimicking diet and maybe have some bone broth or some calories in the evening just to, because I'm not as concerned about going deep into autophagy. I'm 20 years younger than he is. For him, it's probably a little more important to get a little more intense, but I'm still trying to perform and do certain things, and so those calories are probably a little more important for me. So it just depends on your goals as well. And some people have trouble keeping weight on, and most people are fasting and mimicking diet, they get a little more muscle sparing and just a water and fast as well. Good question, Jesse.
Ben, are you still doing the NAD injection that burns for 15 minutes?
Burns. No. Very uncomfortable. I switched to patches. Yeah, you get a slow bleed patch over like 6 hours. So you can still deliver like 500 milligrams, just spread over 6 hours. You still have to go to a clinic to sit under an IV for 6 or 8 hours or whatever. And I am a fan of, based on the fact that your NAD ratios tend to become a little less favorable as you age, and it appears to have some pretty good effects on the human body and on mitochondrial function of getting NAD into the diet in some way. You can use like fermented foods, fasting, and different forms of tea to do it, but I feel pretty good when I mainline that stuff into my system, just my sleep cycles, my energy levels a lot. So I just don't do the injections anymore.
You get it through a doctor?
Yeah, I get it from the NAD clinic in San Diego, and right now, I've messed around with everything, like the NAD injections and nicotinamide riboside, NMN, NAD supplementation. Right now, all I do is once a week an NAD patch, which is about 500 mgs, and then I drink that Pabiarco bark tea pretty much every day. I have a little bit of powder with some other kind of autophagy-inducing compounds, like quercetin, glycine, and chamomile. What's that?
500 is a pretty good dose.
No, 500 is a pretty decent dose for NAD.
But, I mean, aren't a lot of people taking that orally daily?
That's a hefty oral dose.
Exactly.
Yeah, and there's also a difference when you mainline directly in the bloodstream. You get a lot of oral and liver loss. So if you were to take, like, True Diagen or Lysium Spaces, I think those capsules are 150, 200 milligrams tops. Recommendation is one a day. So, you're doubling or tripling that and mainlining directly to the bloodstream. So there's a totally different effect. Some evidence that might do better getting into the cells, and particularly in the neural tissue, when you bypass the gastric absorption.
And you're recommending that to most of your clients now, the patch?
Clients who want to use NAD but don't want a lot of the discomfort of an IV. Yeah. Works pretty well.
There's some IV NAD.
Okay. Yeah. I'd love to feel that Superman burn. Actually, the Superman effect after the burn, right?
Yeah. What other questions? Any others?
Okay. Out of personal thing.
This question is about exercise-induced hypoglycemia that is not for a person who is diabetic. How to deal with it?
Eat and also don't eat. I'd say eat during exercise, like save your feeding for during exercise. Don't eat right before. Like wait till you get 20, 30 minutes into the session and use like some kind of bar or goo or other, you can use like amino acids or ketones or something else, but generally, you go up, you eat your pre-workout meal, you start to work out, you get that hypoglycemic drop from the insulin release from the meal that you've had. And the trick is to just, because I experiment with this a lot, when I was just racing triathlon at 3 workouts a day, you just don't eat before the workout, save your meal for literally during the actual workout.
I've been doing like the applesauce crusher, like a little pouch, but doing myself harm, you think, with that insulin?
During exercise, no, that's at least your worries.
During exercise, though, I mean, you got to, if you're doing pretty intense exercise, though, you're shunting away from your gut the amount that you're able to absorb. So maybe having some fat before as well, especially if you have gut issues. I think we were talking, you may have some gut issues. So if you have gut issues, then during exercise, it's great for them with no gut issues, but if you've got gut issues,
you probably want to think ahead a little bit.
It would be interesting to see what ketones do inside of these ketones, because theoretically that would actually decrease your blood sugar.
That's not what I was wondering.
Yeah, so I'd be interested to see if you'd like actually pass out.
You don't care what your glucose level is. You care how you feel when your glucose level is low. So ketones should help help with that.
You also have a really good new ketones and glucose at the same time. Like rock people.
If that'd be like ketone ester, take a shot of HVMN and a
gel pack. So you're dumping alpha-ester and fructose in your system at the same time as ketones and go for days.
So those ketone esters are kind of top pricey ones.
About $30. I've got a bottle in my backpack. I can show you.
You can use the salts too. They're not.
It tastes really good. Work that good.
This question is for the panel. He's asking if they have ever had consistently bad sleep because of their work schedule and family obligations and stuff like that, and what they do to counter it and get the best sleep possible.
If you can get someone to take your kids,
based on the evidence that I've seen, a few of the things that mitigate the effects of a lost night of sleep. Number one is brief spurts of high-intensity interval training. We're talking like 5 to 10 minute brief spurts of high-intensity interval training. Blasting yourself with large amounts of artificial light, like blue light in the morning, to reset your circadian rhythm. And you can do the same with sunlight or blue light blocks or any of these devices like the human charger or the retimer to reset your circadian rhythm and induce sleep onset at an earlier time. Regular meal timing, don't skip breakfast. That'll also be a good circadian cue. And then other than light and exercise and meal timing, those are really some of the biggies when it comes to kind of like renormalizing sleep architecture. So I do.
There are times in your life with young kids and other times when it's just not going to be optimal. I think it's important, too, to talk to people about not freaking out about that. I mean, do whatever you can to mitigate it, but don't cause extra cortisol spikes.
You want to just embrace it. Start drinking Monster drinks. You got to go all in if you're going to do it.
Adderall.
Now, there's a little bit of chemistry that goes into it, too. I mean, like night shifts or other times, if you have to be up during the day and you had a bad night shift before. Even like just thinking about the half-life of some things, like coffee. A lot of people drink coffee a lot to combat the effects of a lost night's sleep, but then you got a half-life of maybe 6 hours, so then you're hurting the sleep the next night. So this may not be like a common, you talk about smoking, this may not be a common thing you may hear, but a little bit of nicotine gum, potentially, instead of coffee, if you've got a half-life of 1 or 2 hours, may help. For me, the ketone esters, like we talked about, if I have a bad night's sleep because my one-year-old is up and then I have to do something where I got to be mentally on the next afternoon, instead of coffee, I may try the ketone esters or a little bit of nicotine gum. It's got a shorter half-life, so I don't affect the next
one. And I'm going for the same thing, but instead of doing that, I exercise, which is basically giving me the same response. I get from the exercise, and get some ketone production, you know, getting some stimulation, just like you would get from nicotine, just from exercise. So similar sorts of stuff. In terms of how do you manage it from a lifestyle standpoint to decrease the risk associated with it, the thing that I'm most convinced about is to not alter your diet and the rest of your lively habits outside of your circadian rhythm. So if you are all up all night for whatever reason, don't eat that while you're up all night. So stay to your regular eating schedule. Don't change it for being up all night or for whatever is altering your rhythm. Try to stick to your regular daily habits in terms of eating, exercise, and the rest of your sleep as best you can outside of that time where you were augmented. And I think that in the long run is the best shot you have at decreasing the negative effects of not giving you enough sleep, whether it's REM or anything.
Yeah, a lot of this stuff works for jet lag too, and this is probably my last comment because I want to hang out with my kids a little bit before I get them down to bed for the night. But yeah, drink a cup of coffee, smoke a cigarette, take some modafinil, hit the aerosol bike, and you're good to go. Make sure you do so under copious amounts of artificial light.
Don't smoke a cigarette. No. All right, Ben's going to hang out with his kid. We'll be here a little while longer if you all have questions. So thanks for coming. This has been a lot of fun for us. And, we'll be here if you have any more questions.
so much.
Thanks, you guys.
All right, folks. I know that the audio wasn't the greatest on this episode, but I really hope you got a lot out of it. I'll put all the show notes, including links to the websites of all the different, you know, the doctors and the Kentucky Castle where this thing was recorded, and the original episode where I spoke leading up to this particular Q&A. I'll put all that over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/Kentucky2. That's bengreenfieldfitness.com/Kentucky2. So thanks for listening. Have an amazing week. I hope this has been helpful for you. I love you. Mwah. Later. Well, thanks for listening to today's show. You can grab all the show notes, the resources, pretty much everything that I mentioned over at bengreenfieldfitness.com, along with plenty of other goodies from me, including the highly helpful Ben Recommends page, which is a list of pretty much everything that I've ever recommended for hormones, sleep, digestion, fat loss, performance, and plenty more. Please also know that all the links, all the promo codes that I mentioned during this and every episode help to make this podcast happen and to generate income that enables me to keep bringing you this content every single week. So when you listen in, be sure to use the links in the show notes, use the promo codes that I generate, because that helps to float this thing.